This week, the mysterious idea of a trial by the four elements inside Masonic ritual. A new idea? An old idea? Is it original to Freemasonry in any way, shape, or form? Brother Patrick Day takes on the topic in Masonic Mythbusters and leaves no stone unturned. Then we've got exclusive news about MasonicCon Chicago. We're revealing topics, additional presentations, and a whole lot more. And then we will wrap it up with a great article called After the East. So many times, we get the blues after we leave the East. What do we do now? We're irrelevant. But are we? The topic will be explored in depth, and I think by the end of it, you'll have a new passion, a new inspiration. All this and more. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back to the WZY podcast. This is episode number 606. Got a lot of love from you all when I was under the weather, so thank you guys so much. I'm still not back 100%, but we're going to call it 99%, I hope. And anyway, as always, I want to start out the program by thanking our contributors, our fellows, producers, and legacy partners. All of you have been assisting in the production of this podcast through your financial support, which is so amazing, and I am so grateful for. We've been doing the show since July of 2011, and it is no small endeavor. Just like anything else that we all have that we do on the side to assist in Masonry, it takes a lot of time and effort, and that is something that I take very seriously. I could not do it the way we do it and continue to add value to the program without all of you. So I do, one more time, just want to say thank you to all of you who are assisting there. If you're curious on how you can help the show, maybe you're thinking, I'd love to do something cool, I don't know what to do. Well, listen, there's options for everybody, whether you want to donate 50 cents or 10 bucks, whatever the case may be. Whether you want to do that on a monthly basis or a single-time gift, that's all awesome too. All the money goes right back into the production of this show. And you can find out all of that information and more if you head on over to WCYpodcast.com and then click on Support the Show. There are options via PayPal, via Patreon, and again, I very much appreciate all the help. Thanks again for considering. Now, the first thing I want to get into this week is a brand new Masonic Mythbusters. So, let's get into that right now.
In a digital landscape filled with historical inaccuracy, out-of-context quotes on memes and soundbites, there is an epidemic of fraternal occult mythological and historical misinformation. It's time to set the record straight. Masonic Mythbusters with Patrick Day.
If you have ever seen the Red Degrees of Germania Lodge No. 46 of New Orleans, Louisiana, it really is an impressive ritual. They've come to Denver a few times, and it is quite a rite to behold. I don't feel there's any need to get into the history of their ritual, as that is clearly outlined on their website, which was largely produced by Arturo de Hoya. Basically, the lodge worked in German, and then their old ritual was likely a translation of William Morgan's expose, Illustrations of Masonry, with some modifications and corrections. Then, in 1940, the lodge adopted a hybridization of Jacques Fulhouse's Scottish Rite Craft Masonry Ritual and Louisiana's York Rite Ritual, which they exemplify, that they will travel to other jurisdictions to exemplify the first degree. It's really cool, and if you ever get a chance to see it, go. Do it. It's awesome. Highly recommend it. A particular interest in their ritual is the trial by the elements. The last time I got to see this, I was voluntold to help with the air, water, and earth parts, which was cool. It was really cool until I realized I was sitting right next to one of the guys who was doing the trial by fire, in which he has a combustible powder in a container at the end of a long pipe, which he blows into a candle. And then this big plume of fire burst forth. I thought my suit was going to incinerate. Now, this aspect of the ritual, the trial by the elements, is a curious one, and something that is heavily discussed in certain Masonic circles. There certainly is something kind of like this, i.e. the four classical elements in Masonic ritual, but it's not trial. Rather, it's a punishment. The penalties for breaking the obligations. The entered apprentice penalty involves earth and water, the fellow craft involves air, and the master mason involves fire and air. So, where do we get this so-called trial by the elements? Is it a late evolution of the penalties? Or was it brought in by outside sources? Well, it's the latter, truth be told. So, let's dive in. Now, the earliest indication we have of any sort of trial by the elements associated with rites of initiation is in the 2nd century CE with Roman author Apuleius' Metamorphoses, or what St. Augustine called the Golden Ass, and this text would be the inspiration for Kafka's great absurdist work of the same title, Metamorphoses, in which the protagonist is turned into a giant insect. Now, I will call Apuleius' work The Golden Ass, just to not be confused with Kafka's work, or Ovid's work of the same name. So, The Golden Ass follows the story of Lucius, who is dabbling in magic, and in an effort to transform himself into a bird, accidentally turns himself into a donkey. Then he goes on this long journey to find a way to turn himself back into a man. Then, towards the end of the novel, Book 11, Lucius he's just utterly devastated. He has been through so much, and is still just a pitiful ass. And while laying on a beach, he begins to pray to the great goddess to deliver him aid. And when he falls asleep, the goddess Isis comes to him in a vision, and directs him to travel and seek out the priest of her eternal religion. And then he does, and is eventually turned back into a man and initiated into the mysteries of Isis. Now, Apuleius spends quite a bit of time describing the ceremonies, purification rites, bathing, fasting, what everyone was wearing, etc. As Lucius begins his katabasis, or ritual descent into the underworld, he states, quote, "I was ravished throughout all the elements, per omnia vectis elementa." Now, there have been various translations of this passage. Adlington translates it as ravished, Hansen translates it as traveled, and on some rather spurious websites I have come across, they would translate it as purified. However, a very literal translation of this passage is, "I was carried through all the elements." Now, it should be understood that Apuleius is writing a novel, and a comical one at that. It is a work of comedy. Now, while the novel has a lot of serious and poignant moments, such as the tale of the old woman who tells Lucius this tale about Cupid and Psyche, it must be borne in mind that this is a comical work of fiction. So, how much weight do we give Apuleius' description of the rites of Isis? Some authors believe absolutely none, while others believe that it could be taken with a grain of salt, and maybe somewhat truthful. It's entirely possible that Apuleius was actually a member, and divulged numerous aspects of the cult, or he could have been satirizing the cult based on what little he knew about it. It should be understood when we read Apuleius' description of Lucius' initiations into the mysteries of Isis, Serapis, and Osiris, the cults themselves were not being satirized, but rather Lucius himself is, owing to his apparent lack of understanding anything he is going through in his initiations. That said, according to Apuleius himself, he was initiated into several mystery cults. Quote, "I have been initiated into various of the Greek mysteries and preserve with the utmost care certain emblems and mementos of my initiation with which the priest presented me. There is nothing abnormal or unheard of in this. Those of you here present who have been initiated into the mysteries of Father Liber know what you keep hidden at home, safe from all profane touch and the object of your silent veneration. But I, as I have said, moved by my religious fervor and my desire to know the truth, have learned mysteries of many a kind, rites in great number and diverse in ceremonies. This is no invention on the spur of the moment. End quote. He does not mention the cult of Isis, nor does he give much detail, but at the very least we may surmise that he had been initiated into some mystery rites. But beyond that, not much else can be discerned. His various initiations may have inspired how he lays out the rites, as described in the Golden Ass, but there simply is not enough known about the cult of Isis, or many of these other mystery cults, to ascertain how accurate Apuleius is being. And remember, they're called mystery cults because what went on is a giant mystery. That's all. The purpose of this lengthy examination of Apuleius and his account of the mysteries of Isis is so we have a full understanding of the potential validity of his statement. I was carried through all the elements. Was that really a thing? Was it a functional innovation? Was it his own personal commentary on the rites as he may have experienced them when he was initiated into this mystery cult or some other? The debate could go on, but suffice to say, this comical novel gives the first mention of any initiation rite that includes all the elements in its ceremonies. We may not even be talking about the classical elements of earth, water, air, and fire, but such indication is being given and certainly could be implied as such. That said, certainly other people have believed Apuleius' account and even assumed that these practices were incorporated in ancient Egyptian rituals long before Hellenic Greek mysteries, and future persons would use his ritual outline as their basis to, I guess, fill in gaps in their understanding of other mystery cults and their ceremonies. The most notable example, and in my opinion was the key text that forever stapled the trial by the elements into ritual initiations, is Abbé Thérèson's The Life of Sethos. Abbé Jean Thérèson was an 18th century French priest and scholar. His most popular work was a two-volume novel called The Life of Sethos, which was published in 1732. And he claims he translated this text from a Greek manuscript that, quote, was found in the library of a foreign nation, end quote. Very descriptive, I know. The novel follows the life of the future king of Egypt, Sethos. Now, very early in the novel, Sethos desires to be admitted into the secret rites, and is at first rejected, but soon thereafter pursues it once more. He claims that Thales and Pythagoras were both members of this distinguished mystery cult. The entrance into the sanctuary was in one of the pyramids of Giza. Sethos is not given permission to be admitted, he just goes for it. He goes into the pyramid and descends a spiraling stair to the bottom of a deep well. As he passes through one of the numerous arches into the subterranean temple, he encounters the following sign. Quote, "Whoever goes through this passage alone and without looking behind him shall be purified by fire, by water, and by air. And if he can vanquish the fears of death, he shall return from the bowels of the earth. He shall see light again, and he shall be entitled to the privilege of preparing his mind for the revelation of the mysteries of the great goddess Isis." End quote. Sethos then undergoes a series of tests whereby he must pass through chambers and navigate the elements. He will pass through a room with fire and an iron-grated floor. He'll find a path along the iron and in between the flames where he can safely pass. Next, he must pass through a water channel that is fed by the waters of the River Nile. He crosses this and comes to a chasm with a raised drawbridge on the other side. Above him are two iron hoops suspended by chains. He grabs a hold of these, dangles over the chasm for a brief moment as the bridge drops before him. He is then admitted into the inner sanctuary of Isis, where he beholds her cult statue and is caused to drink water from the previous channel and told, quote, "Let this water be a draught of Lethe, for forgetfulness with regard to all the false maxims which you have heard from the mouths of profane men," end quote. And then he's offered a concoction of Kakaon, which is the sacred drink of the rites of Eleusis, which is really just mint barley water, and told, quote, "May this be a draught of Messimony, or memory for the lessons which will now be given you by wisdom," end quote. There is no mention of a trial by earth, but given the fact that Sethos is deep underground beneath a pyramid, it stands to reason that this is already the trial by earth. Taraison's novel was immensely popular and highly impactful on both art and initiation rites. It would be one of the influential texts that inspired Mozart's The Magic Flute, and would inspire the enigmatic and strangely perverted French architect Jean-Jacques Lecoq, who did a rendering of a cross-section through an entire temple with its chambers and inner sanctuary, in an ink wash rendering entitled The Gothic House, Maison Gothique. Later authors believe Taraison's work to be so real that near verbatim regurgitations of his descriptions of Sethos's initiations are included in what were considered legitimate works of intense academic rigor, such as Charles Heckthorne, who describes the initiation into the mysteries of Isis in his secret societies of all ages and countries. And he copies almost entirely from Taraison's work, so much so that he appears to be unabashed at his near blatant plagiarism. William Warburton also relies extensively on Taraison's work as factual evidence in his Divine Legation of Moses. Moses' reading includes the purification of sins by the elements in a katabasis in his Illustrated History of Freemasonry. Leadbeater unabashedly cites Apuleius' Golden Ass for the source of his information on the Egyptian mysteries in his work Glimpses of Masonic History. There were countless other authors who looked to Apuleius and Taraison for this information. Sometimes they acknowledge their sources, and other times they're kind of skirting around the fact that their sources are fiction. But all of them come back to the same two authors, Apuleius and Taraison. The examples could just go on and on and on. In fact, you may already be familiar with this initiation narrative from any number of sources, and truth be told, whatever you were reading, it was certainly originally drawing from one of these two novels. The point is that so far, the two most influential texts on the use of the four classical elements in initiation rites are to be found in works of fiction, with no other factual information to support them. For Apuleius and Taraison, it's permissible for them to make these things up. I mean, after all, they're writing novels. But how do we as Masons, men who are supposed to be guided by truth and reason and critical thinking, come to take all of this so seriously? No clue. Seriously, I have no idea. I would venture to say that some Masons were like trying to fill in gaps in Masonic legendary, and others just wanted these things to be real so badly that they convinced themselves it must be real. Trying to substantiate and fill in the gaps would be a venture of monumental proportions. Suffice to say, I have found no other uses of a trial by elements in any ritual form in the interim between Apuleius and Taraison, and its introduction into Masonic ritual most certainly originated in France via Taraison's Life of Sethos. I mean, I guess we get so caught up in myth and legend that we end up presuming these works of fiction were rooted in something much older, and therefore something real. And then when we look at our own Masonic rituals, i.e. the penalties of violating the obligations, and when compared and contrasted with these works of fiction, something resonates. It seems Masonic. I mean, I've even seen Mozart's magic flute used as evidence that these trials by the elements are Masonic, just because Mozart was a Mason. I mean, we seem to have skipped something here if we're relying on an opera as fact. I mean, we might as well take the movie From Hell as proof that Jack the Ripper was a Freemason, if that's how we're going to go about this. And it distorts things, even for serious academics. Take, for instance, Barry Bergdahl, who in a lecture on Jean-Jacques Lacue describes Maison Gothique as Masonic, and claims this may even be evidence that the pornographic architect was a Freemason. I love Barry Bergdahl, and he's one of the most eminent architectural historians of our day. But these narratives of the trial by the elements as being Masonic even lead serious academics astray. I mean, ultimately we must consign ourselves to the fact that the trial by the elements were most likely and most certainly total fabrications, founded in imagination and later asserted as fact. All human institutions, customs, and norms were made up at some time or another. The older the tradition, the more it is deemed valid, what would be called evident by antiquity. So, we can safely say that the idea of a ritual application of the classical elements goes back about 1800 years, and is first mentioned in a work of comical fiction. Then it is later reinvigorated in another work of fiction. And those are our sources. Fictions. It leaves you something to think about, I guess.
Alright, the Trial of Elements. You know, the first time I had heard about this was actually in a tarot deck. That's right, I had purchased the tarot deck, the Masonic Tarot, which is a wonderful tarot deck, but in the book, the white book, you would call it perhaps, or the explanation book that you get with most of your decks, where they explain the symbolism of each card, and sometimes these symbolisms change in terms of their meaning based on who is creating the deck. In this case, it is the Masonic Tarot, so it is created by a purported Mason. And inside of the explanation book, it talks about these four trials. Now, no doubt they seem to connect back to some sort of European origin. My guess is, of course, they come from South America by way of the trade routes in France, and probably connect back to these two fictional tales. It's very interesting when I think about exactly what Patrick Day is trying to tell us here, which is that these things are a part of our Masonic experience, and perhaps we venerate these quote-unquote red degrees or the practices where we find interesting cases of one-off styles of degree work. And we look at it as if the grass is greener, or I wish we could do that, or that's the original way, and we mystify it as holding it above something else. But in actuality, when we do the scholarly work to uncover where these things come from, it often leads to some disappointing notions. Certainly in this case, I wouldn't describe it as disappointing, because it's nothing that I have, like, endeavored to say in my views of Masonry that's the original way it should be, etc., etc. So, very cool, though. I really enjoyed the segment, and I hope you did also. So the next time you're out there and somebody talks about some great rite out there that does these trials by the elements, you can tell them, hey, you know, those come from a couple of works of fiction. And we just kind of put it in our degree work and took it for fact. So the next thing I want to talk about, of course, you guys, I am super excited. We are so close, 26 days away, MasonicCon Chicago. If you have not received the emails, there's been some big changes and big news with MasonicCon Chicago. Of course, the biggest change is that this year it is sponsored by my lodge, Space Novum number 1183 of the Grand Lodge of Illinois. Space Novum's MasonicCon Chicago. Now, we've been saying that this is going to happen on September 16th in 2023. But guess what? It was so popular and we have so much interest, we decided to add a second day. That's right. We're going to start it off September 15th at about 5 p.m. We're going to do an impromptu gathering at the lodge. We'll order some pizza. We'll have two speakers that night. We'll clean up a little bit, and then we're going to walk across the street and have some beverages together and anything else we'd like and talk the night away. Of course, the next day, we'll have a full panel of speakers as well. But to give you guys just a little bit more of a taste here, Friday night, we're going to have James Buckhorn. He is the Grand Lodge of Indiana Masonic Education Chair. He's going to be doing a presentation called, get ready for this, Your Mentor Was a Romantic Guy, The Empiric Strikes Back, A Lack of Curiosity Killed the Cat, and Why You Should Learn to Start Questioning Everything and Love the Authentic School. The whole premise behind this, you can watch the videos that we've released on this, but in general, James is going to tackle such topics that have been given to us from our mentors and things that we've been taught over time, and to look at them with a critical eye and say, is it true? And then we're really excited as well. We've got illustrious Brother Stephen L. Harrison speaking on Friday night as well. He's doing a presentation called The Third Ruby. Now, if that sounds a little Demolay-ish, that's because it is. It is a wonderful presentation about Frank Land. And if you click the link to the video that will explore the topic a little bit more for you, I think you'll agree it's going to be a wonderful and emotionally connected talk. Certainly, Demolay will definitely enjoy the topic and have a special connection to it. And did I mention that this is all open to the public? That's right. You don't have to be a Mason to come. All of our topics are open to the public, both on Friday and Saturday night. So just grab your ticket and you can come on in. Really encouraging. We've got the Demolay coming out also for that night and also on Saturday. They're not there to serve or do anything else other than to promote the wonderful works that they're doing. We're having Lakes chapter of Demolay come out. Now on Saturday, September 16th, we've got some great stuff happening as well. We're starting the day bright and early at 8 a.m. We'll have some opening remarks and things at around 8:30. And then we're opening it up with Chad Kapinski's work on a presentation called The Closed Book of John Shearer. This is heavily steeped in art, and I think if you click the YouTube and you watch the YouTube link and you watch the promotional video about this, you're going to definitely get excited. We've also got Joe Martinez. His topic is called The Application of Esotericism in the Craft. So many things we do in Freemasonry are necessarily esoteric or philosophic in nature. Esoteric meaning an internal sort of intrinsic quality to what these things are. Joe is going to take apart the ritual that we are all familiar with, including some Illinois specifics, and talk about the philosophical and esoteric value of those things. He's going to demystify it a little bit for us. And then in this premier presentation, Spencer A. Hammond, a virtual Leonardo da Vinci of the 21st century, is doing a presentation called Deus in Machina, or Machina, Philosophy and Finding the Divine in Esoteric Woodworking. Spencer is a craftsman throughout, both in mind and in physical matter. What he dreams, he can make. And in this particular presentation, I think you are going to find extreme inspiration. We've got Darren A. Laners later on in the day talking about the magical royal art, Freemasonry. He's going to talk about a lot of the things that we take for granted in Freemasonry and their deeper significance and meanings, and perhaps how we can learn to explore these and implement these ideas in lodges in order to make things a little bit more serious. I'm very excited to say that Robert W. Marshall, coming out of the Grand Lodge of Texas, all the way down from Waco, Texas, actually, is coming up to give us a really fun presentation called Monsters in the Making, Tracing the Mark of Masonry on the Horror Genre and Why It Matters. In this presentation, Robert is going to be giving us information about all of the times where the craft has influenced things that happen in the films and books and pop culture and those horror genres. It's a very exciting and very entertaining talk. And if you think that that means it's not going to be cited or academic in nature, you're wrong. Brother Robert Marshall brings all of this amazing information into his talk. And in fact, one of the best parts about it is he's going to tell us why it matters as modern day Masons. If you were ever looking for secrets of a secret sort of organization, well, look no further. We've got James Fry coming on to talk the secrets of the Swedenborgian Rite. He's so close to writing a book about this. In fact, we just did a Masonic Roundtable episode with Brother James Fry that could serve to give you a slight primer for what he's going to be talking about. But make no mistake, he'll blow your minds with a lot of really cool stuff, and he's really only scratching the surface. So you're going to want to check this out, and if it interests you, you're going to want to pick up the book when it comes out. Wrapping up the day, we've got Right Worshipful Brother Michael Jarzabek. He's doing a presentation on H.P. Lovecraft and Freemasonry, a considerably twisted version. What is the connection there? Well, there are some connections that he has since made in the Fraternal Review's most recent issue of the Fraternal Review, where it is all about Lovecraft and Freemasonry. There have been some claims that there is some reaching within those articles, but those reachings really require some imagination, something that ran rampant with somebody like H.P. Lovecraft. But in our private talks between Michael and I, he's revealed some very controversial and startling connections between Lovecraft and Masonry that are real. And I think he's going to bring us some of that information. So that is the 2 days of events. We've got a lunch break and bio breaks all built in so you guys don't have to worry about missing anything. Lunch is not just an hour. We've got 90 minutes for lunch that day. There are about 36 restaurants in the local area, so we are going to essentially just break for lunch and come back and be able to eat where and with who you would like. So 9 speakers over 2 days. We've got some recommended hotels all set up for you all. We're working on block rates, so mention MasonicCon Chicago if you'd like when you're making your reservations at the Holiday Inn Express or Sonesta Simply Suites in Chicago Libertyville. If you want to know more and you want to get all the information when it comes out, go ahead and join the mailing list. It's on the website, MasonicConChicago.com. I want to thank our most recent sponsor, Brother Kevin Standen, who he bought a ticket and then he decided he was going to go ahead and sponsor the event as well. And this is going to be his first in-person conference. I'm super excited to meet him in person. We've conversed very numerous times via Zoom and through email. And so I'm very much looking forward to that. So a huge thanks goes out to Brother Kevin. If you're curious about sponsoring the event, certainly just reach out to me personally, or you can go to the website and you know what you want to do. You can just scroll down to become a sponsor and do it that way. All the ticket sales are through Space Novum Lodge. It'll be a PayPal link when you buy your ticket. Your receipt is your ticket, and I'm keeping track of all those, and we'll just check you in right away when you get there. Everybody's going to get a personalized badge, which will have the schedule and everything on it, and that comes with your general admission. If you'd like a VIP ticket, that is the way to go. You're going to get some swag, including our exclusive pin and coin, which, you guys, are so amazing. I'll be sharing the images, the mock-up images of those, the digital renderings, as soon as possible. I designed the front of the coin and the pin, and Brother Spencer Hammon designed the back of the coin. And you know it's amazing because he designed last year's pin and coin single-handedly, and of course that awesome Art Deco style that he and I are both fond of, and that this event really tries to embody in terms of its style. I would encourage you, if you're out there and you're some sort of Masonic administrator of a sort, we've got a couple flyers that have been produced for the event, flyer number 2, which has been updated. If you click on that on the website, it will download a PDF that you can then send out to your groups and your email lists. That would be awesome if you could do that. We are actively selling tickets, and we want to sell more tickets. We want more people to come. Ticket sales have been amazing. We've got a ton of folks going. We've probably got about 30 tickets left, not a whole lot left, so we are looking forward to that. There is no online option. I know that's upsetting to some of you. However, this is by design. We are looking to put together a very exclusive in-person event, and we will record the lectures, and those recordings will be available to our VIP ticket holders as soon as they are processed, and will then go public after about 6 months. So then they will be able to be viewed by just about anybody. Anyone who's out there who would like to watch them on YouTube, they'll be on the channel there. Of course, you can subscribe to the MasonicCon Chicago YouTube channel, which will let you know every time we publish a cool video or announce something via video. And I think that's about it regarding MasonicCon Chicago. So I just want to invite you all to the website. Go ahead and get your ticket, whether it's a VIP or general admission. We are not doing any meals together. Again, there's no festive board, nothing like that. Once we break for the meals, it is up to each and every brother to go ahead and decide where they would like to go and who they'd like to go with. And the hope here is that it makes it easy for everybody to network and explore the various options for food and entertainment that you would like to do. So thanks so much, you all, for already making this a success. The piece I would love to read for you this week is something that I find to be a wonderful topic. There's been so many things written about getting ready for the yeast, preparing for your year as the worshipful master. And yet, oftentimes we are sailing toward the end of our term in the East, and we have to ask ourselves, what the heck are we going to do next? Well, this was a topic addressed by Christine Wilson Slack. Now, she is a contributor to our book, How to Charter a Lodge, A No-Nonsense, Unsanctioned Guide. And she's also a wealth of knowledge on these topics. So this is called After the East. Let's check this out. Prior to becoming the master of a lodge, seated in the east of the temple, the Freemason may begin their career in any number of offices, depending on the Masonic obedience to which they belong. In some orders, lodges are small, and the new Freemason may be required to perform several offices at the same time. In my order, my first few years were filled with floor work, secretarial work, music, and a host of different roles. I learned a lot about the needs of the individual offices as well as how they work in conjunction with others. Was it optimal? It suited me, and while some might disagree, it was what we had. I was grateful for the opportunity to serve and to learn so much so quickly. That service was rewarded with a growing lodge. We soon were able to fill offices with individuals, each one learning in depth their position and place. This too had its treasures, as each member was soon able to grasp a whole essence of working together to a harmonious end. It wasn't until I was installed as the second of the lodge that I contemplated moving to the east and having to be, quote-unquote, in charge. The second in the lodge sits in the west and is typically called a warden or senior warden. The terrifying and ominous prospect of eventually taking over the care and feeding of the lodge had also filled me with questions. What would I do differently? What plans did I have? What would be my legacy? Quickening evolution. It is said, the Freemasonry quickens the evolution of man. What this means is that the circumstances of the lodge change and undulate, causing the Masonic officer to shift and change to the best of their abilities. One should note that the lodge is not the temple or building where Freemasons meet, rather it is the body of Freemasons that come together for the ritual purpose. It is the group, not the place. Therefore, the lodge, a group of people, is the catalyst for the evaluation of the individuals that are part of it. At least, this is what I see that it means. In practical terms, it means that all the planning in the world can't prepare you for everything. As the second, I remember sitting across from the master to whom I was supposed to be supporting and helping and feeling a sense of annoyance and frustration. Why is she doing it this way? Why not that way? I had to learn to break down, tear apart, and dismantle. This can be overwhelming for some. If their master would just move out of the way, the real work can begin. How utterly naive and how utterly appropriate, if a bit out of control. Arriving in the East. The first thing that comes to one upon arriving in the East is the notion that perhaps you weren't as good a Mason as you thought you were. I don't mean that you don't know how to rule a lodge. We know this comes with practice. Some may be born to leadership and find their path easily, while others need to cut through the weeds and jungle to make their way. The master in the East learns how to file the paperwork and execute the ritual. They may be able to train and educate others in the art of Freemasonry. There's always a lot of work and a myriad of questions to answer. However, sitting in the East causes one to reflect on their own Masonic career to this point. How did they treat their masters before them? How did they respond to requests for help either from officers or their fellow brothers? Did they treat Freemasonry with the reverence it deserves? Many times the answer is that we know we could have done better. Some masters overcompensate and try to be even better, whatever that might mean. They swing too far one way, a pendulum swinging wildly out of control. They leave their lodge perhaps more chaotic than they found it. They might also swing the opposite way, realizing that the job was a lot more complicated than they believed. They devolve to letting others run the lodge, assume their officers know their jobs, and eventually chaos infiltrates. Luckily, both of these outcomes are rare occurrences. Sitting in the East is a lot harder and in some ways easier than we believed. Masters rise to the occasion through humility, determination, grit, and compassion. They learn to let go, delegate, and follow up. Caring for your members goes a long way to success. Are they perfect? No, but generally they know it. And they know they can always do better. The silent watcher. Then, in a whoosh, they are done. Over. They now sit to the left of the master, assisting as needed, but they become the silent watcher. They become the shadow. And perhaps to some, they think they are irrelevant. They feel the lodge move on, move forward, with a new captain at the wheel. It is the rare master who moves back into an officer's role in their own lodge. In some Masonic jurisdictions, the mastership may only be 1 year, and in others, it may be as long as 4 or 5, or whatever the case might be. In most cases, the effect is still the same. There is a loss in a mourning period where the master might not feel as relevant as they did the day before. This position of immediate past master is, to me, one that relates to the apprentice, someone who is newly initiated into Freemasonry. It's the octave above the apprentice, creating a chord of harmony, relationship, and continuity within the lodge. There are 7 regular offices in the lodge, and the past master completes the cycle to bring the work to the next level. They connect with experience, history, and ritual to bring careful insights to the next generation. A call for vaster service. In real practical terms, the past master is the memory of ritual and procedure. There are certain positions within the lodge meeting that are ideal for a past master to fill. Certain officers that require that experience and knowledge to execute correctly and create continuity. Their knowledge helps the new master run things smoothly and harmoniously. While 3 rule the lodge, the past master is truly a left hand for the master, a confidant that may provide whispers of the immediate past. Yet most lodges, district, and jurisdictions need so much more. They require the pillars of the columns to remain strong, vibrant, and active. The past master may be a stabilizing force for not only the lodge, but also maybe for others in the area. They may be writers and builders able to support Freemasonry from the depth of their experience. They may contribute to their overall order or to a wider set of lodges if they feel so inclined. If anything, the past master has a wider range of service than ever before. There's a world of Freemasonry that requires their experience. Much as we need the masters of crafts to mentor and teach new workers, life for the past master is not fading, not at all. If anything, the world becomes far vaster than they could ever imagine. Dang. Talk about a call to service. If we were ever leaving the East, or we found ourselves out of the East and completely irrelevant with no direction where to go, this is a wake-up call. What a wide array of things that we can now serve. This added experience. We just need to find out what it is and begin to apply to it. I love this message. It keeps us looking for more service. Because as we all know, just like receiving your degrees doesn't mean you're a better man, it means we've received the degrees to which call us to be a better man, to reflect on the lessons within the ritual, to study the philosophies, and to implement those in our lives. And once we've been able to administrate the craft at the local level, perhaps it's time to spread your wings and find even more to go after. Maybe you should write a book. Maybe start a blog. Maybe contact the Grand Lodge and ask how you can help promote something in Freemasonry and using your own talents wherewith God has blessed you as well to His glory as to the benefit of your fellow creatures, as we like to say. That's it for this week. I want to thank you all for joining us. My plan for the next episode is to have a brand new segment from Brother Mark St. Cyr, and I really want to talk about the freshly finished John Skeen Conference, which was an absolute amazing event. I was talking with a good friend at the event. We were talking about FOMO, F-O-M-O, fear of missing out. And he said, we need to talk about something else. COMO, C-O-M-O, confirmation of missing out. Because that's in fact what we have now for those who did not find the ability to make it to this event. It was absolutely amazing. And I will talk a little bit more about that. Well, a whole lot more about that next week. So until then, I'd like to say stay on the level. And for Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.
WCY Media.